Secretary of State Antony Blinken meets with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
Netanyahu told Blinken that he would not accept an end to the war in Gaza as part of a potential hostage deal.
Plus, police retake a campus building from protesters in New York.
Protesters say they have three demands from Colombia: divesting from companies supporting Israel's government, greater transparency in university finances, and amnesty for students and faculty disciplined over the protests.
And later, Turkey tries to take on more of a mediating role in the Middle East, and to look at the number of casualties caused by Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Today is Wednesday, May 1st, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Wednesday. The top U.S. diplomat is pushing to get more aid into Gaza while urging Hamas to accept a deal that would halt fighting and bring Israeli hostages home. Blinken reportedly told Netanyahu that the U.S. still opposes a military operation in Rafah, and Netanyahu told Blinken that he will not end the war until Hamas is completely destroyed. For a closer look, I'm joined by VOA's Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Secretary of State Blinken and Prime Minister Netanyahu had a private meeting in which Netanyahu told Blinken that he would not accept an end to the war in Gaza as part of a potential hostage deal. He apparently told Blinken that Israel is interested in reaching a deal and determined to topple Hamas. Now, Hamas has said that its condition for accepting any ceasefire is an Israeli promise that it will not go into Rafah. Blinken is also going to the Kerem Shalom crossing point to inspect the aid that's going into Gaza. In the last couple of weeks, Israel has sharply increased the amount of aid going into Gaza. And Secretary Blinken also met with families of the hostages and said that everything the United States is doing is to ensure that the hostages will get home to their families.
So it seems to me like Netanyahu and Hamas are talking about two different things. And tell me if I'm wrong here. If Netanyahu is saying he will not end the war, but Hamas is saying they will release hostages if Israel does not go into Rafah. Those aren't the same thing, are they?
No, they're not exactly the same thing. It seems, and again, the details of this are still a little bit fuzzy, that we're talking about sort of two stages. And in the first stage, Hamas would release, it started off as 40, and now the number is somewhere between 20 and 30, apparently because some of them are dead, what they're calling humanitarian cases: women, children, older people, and wounded people. And then in exchange, Israel would free hundreds of Palestinian prisoners, including some who had murdered Israelis, and would agree to a ceasefire of anywhere between 30 days and 6 weeks. And then there would be a second stage at some point that would include all of the hostages and the bodies and a larger number of Palestinian prisoners. So it's not clear of the timing of this. It's not clear if Israel is saying it won't agree to hold off on a Rafah invasion even during this first stage. I mean, the details of this are still a little fuzzy.
So as fuzzy as the details are and as fluid as the situation is, earlier in Riyadh, Blinken was saying that the Israeli offer was what he called extraordinarily generous on Israel's part. And now it seems that Israel is either walking that back or perhaps Blinken had it wrong. What happened there? Where's that disconnect?
Is that Israel agreed to accept a smaller number of hostages in exchange for a ceasefire. And I think that's what he was talking about when he said the offer is extraordinarily generous, where it started with 40 and now it's somewhere between 20 and 30.
And what's the sense on the streets in Jerusalem? What are the Israeli people looking for?
Well, I think, first of all, the Israeli people are tired of the war. It's now been almost 7 months. A lot of people, you know, at the very beginning, Israel called up hundreds of thousands of reserve troops. Many of them served, you know, 3 or 4 months. You're talking about men into their 30s, 40s, you know, have families, have jobs. And now many of them are being called for a second round of reserve duty. So I think there is this sense that people are tired of the war. At the same time, people still support the army but there is a growing sense that it's the government's job to bring the hostages back and that they need to do anything that is necessary in order to bring people home.
And we'll leave it there for today. VOA's Linda Gradstein is in Jerusalem. Linda, thanks for your time today.
Sure. Thank you.
Meanwhile, police officers arrived at the campus of the University of California in Los Angeles on Wednesday after clashes broke out between pro-Palestinian protesters and a group of counter-demonstrators supporting Israel. Student rallies have spread to dozens of schools across the U.S. in recent days, expressing opposition to Israel's war in Gaza, often resulting in police being called in to quell or clear protests. The student protests in the United States have also taken on political overtones in the run-up to November's election, with Republicans accusing some university administrators of turning a blind eye to anti-Semitic rhetoric and harassment. It's a similar situation in New York City, as police there removed protesters from a campus building they were occupying. Ryan Brooks of Reuters has this update.
New York City police raided Columbia University and arrested dozens of pro-Palestinian demonstrators late on Tuesday. Groups of helmeted police marched into the elite university's campus around 9 p.m. to remove a protest camp that the school has tried to dismantle for nearly 2 weeks. Some of the students had also seized Hamilton Hall, an academic building, and a line of officers climbed into the second story using a police vehicle with a ladder. The NYPD released a video of the raid on X with a statement saying the school had requested assistance to take back their campus.
Shame on you!
Shortly after officers had moved in, Columbia University President Manush Safiq requested that police stay on campus until at least May 17th, 2 days after graduation, saying in a letter it was, quote, to maintain order and ensure that encampments are not reestablished. Protesters say they have 3 demands from Columbia: divesting from companies supporting Israel's government, greater transparency in university finances, and amnesty for students and faculty disciplined over the protests. This week, Safiq said Columbia would not divest from finances in Israel, but offered to invest in health and education in Gaza and also make Columbia's holdings more transparent. Hours before the police entered the school, city officials claimed external actors were provoking an escalation of the protests. New York City Police Commissioner Edward A. Caban.
We are seeing the tactics changing in a way that's endangering public safety. These once peaceful protests are being exploited by professional outside agitators, and the safety of all students, faculty, and staff are now a concern.
One student protest leader, Mahmoud Khalil, has disputed the idea that outsiders led the occupation. Columbia has been the focal point of a wave of protests across the United States. More broadly, the October 7th attack on southern Israel by Hamas militants from Gaza and the ensuing Israeli offensive on Gaza have unleashed the biggest surge in American student activism since 2020's anti-racism protests. Counter-protesters have accused demonstrators of fomenting anti-Jewish hatred, while the pro-Palestinian side say they are being unfairly branded as anti-Semitic for criticizing Israel's government.
That's Ryan Brooks of Reuters reporting for us today. You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. An update from Kyiv in a few minutes, but our look at the situation in the Middle East continues in Turkey. That's where President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is stepping up his efforts to play a more prominent role in the Gaza conflict. The Turkish leader hosted Hamas's political leader, Ismail Haniyeh, on April 20th. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's recent high-profile meeting with Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh was an attempt to quell growing domestic criticism of his complicated stance on the war. He has maintained Israel trade links while condemning Israel's war on Hamas.
In order to convince conservative voters that there is no there is no such thing as a hypocritical approach, Turkey might emerge as a potential candidate country to host Hamas if Qatar decides to, you know, send Hamas members abroad.
Turkey wants a wider role in resolving the Gaza conflict, and observers say Ankara sees an opportunity amid reports that Qatar may be preparing to expel the group. In his bid to boost Turkey's role as a mediator in Gaza, Erdogan has been stepping up diplomatic efforts with Egypt, recently hosting Egyptian Foreign Minister Sameh Shoukry. Relations between Turkey and Egypt have been warming after years of tensions, and analysts say there is room for cooperation.
Both are very active in the rhetorical space in terms of their deep sympathy for the Palestinians in Gaza. At the same time, they maintain their commercial, diplomatic, and security ties with Israel.
But analysts warn Erdogan's public attacks on Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu limit any mediating role for Turkey.
The government has to moderate its tone, has to repair its dialogue with Israel, because as it stands, Turkey is no longer perceived as an impartial third-party actor which can take take on a role as a mediator. And instead of perhaps advocating Hamas, endorsing Hamas, Turkey has to shift to a more balanced position.
Erdogan this month blamed Iran and Israel for increasing tensions, a break from only criticizing Israel. Analysts say Turkey's close ties to Hamas could counter Iran's influence on the group. Observers see Erdogan's overtures to Hamas as a factor behind the postponement of a planned visit to Washington in May. It was blamed on scheduling issues.
With the dramatic scenes we're getting from Gaza, Erdogan would have felt compelled to put Gaza high up on his list. And I don't think the White House is in a place, for all types of reasons, including domestic difficulty of this issue, to be hosting a world leader who's going to criticize in front of cameras U.S. position on Gaza.
Despite the postponement of Erdogan's visit, both Washington and Ankara say they remain committed to high-level cooperation. Doreen Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
And now to Ukraine. There has been a new drone attack on Russian territory, and the Ukrainian Ministry of Foreign Affairs introduced a digital media representative to address consular questions. VOA correspondent Anna Chernikova has the details from Kyiv.
In the early hours of Wednesday, drones attacked the Ryazan and Voronezh regions of Russia, and fire broke out at the Ryazan oil refinery. Ukrainian media, with reference to anonymous sources in the Ukrainian special services, report that the attacks were carried out by the Ukrainian intelligence service. According to preliminary information, the drones attacked the oil refinery around 3 a.m. local time. Local residents report the sound of two explosions. The governor of the Ryazan region confirmed the fact of the attack, saying that one drone was allegedly shot down. He did not mention the total number of the drones that attacked the plant. The governor of the Voronezh region reported that two drones were shot down there. The Ryazan oil refinery is under the control of the Russian Rosneft company. Most of its products are exported. Media outlet Politico reports that the wave of strikes by Ukrainian drones on oil refineries in the depths of Russia forced the Kremlin to defend its own territory while at the same time waging war. But the attacks have also left the world's largest oil nation running out of gasoline, and local fuel prices have skyrocketed. Diesel prices for Russian consumers have risen by almost 10% in the past week alone, according to Russian government data. Gasoline prices also hit a six-month high, up more than 20% since the beginning of the year, as more factories are forced to shut down production. Meanwhile, President Zelensky in his morning address said that he held meetings with top military officials to discuss the situation at the front, update on the military aid delivery, and Ukrainian actions to disrupt Russia's plans.
We need a significant speed-up of deliveries to strengthen the capabilities of our soldiers tangibly. It is not Russian air bombs and assault operations that should dominate the front line, but our Ukrainian initiative. Our air defenses, our artillery, our drones. We are solving this partially due to our production and to everyone who helps the defense forces. We have achieved particular results regarding the matter of drones. I'm grateful to everyone who works for this cause, who produces drones, who trains operators, who provides everything we need. I thank each of our partners who are now really doing everything they can to strengthen our position. We are really counting on the promptness of the U.S. deliveries.
In lighter news, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Ukraine announced on May 1st the creation of a digital person using artificial intelligence technology that will officially address media requests for consular information. Victoria Shi is her name. Shi is a Ukrainian abbreviation for artificial intelligence. She was created on the basis of a real person, a Ukrainian singer, Rosalind Nomber. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs has provided several levels of protection for Victoria Shi against digital forgeries. A QR code is placed on each original video of the consular representative, which leads to a text version of the same comment on the official page of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Victoria Shi will be reporting operational and verified information of the consular department of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Ukraine to the public. She will inform journalists of news about the work of consuls in protecting the rights and interests of Ukrainian citizens abroad and responding to incidents or emergency situations. Minister of Foreign Affairs of Ukraine Dmytro Kuleba noted that the use of a digital person generated by artificial intelligence for consular commenting is primarily a saving of time and resources for the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
The number of Russian soldiers killed in combat since the beginning of the full-scale invasion of Ukraine remains a secret that the Kremlin goes to great lengths to hide. However, open-source research has recently yielded figures that show Moscow's losses have been heavy. Ricardo Marquina has this report, narrated for us by Elizabeth Chernov.
A memorial ceremony is held by occupation officials in Crimea for Russian soldiers killed in action. Ceremonies like this, as well as public information derived from obituaries in the local media, give independent sources like the opposition media outlet Mediazona precious tidbits of information. Those added up to a figure of 50,000 Russian soldiers killed in action during these 2 years of war. Their investigation was based on open-source intelligence with the hope of shedding light on facts the Kremlin has kept hidden, at least among the sources it can control. Arno Reusser founded the Open Source Intelligence Branch of the Dutch Defense Intelligence and Security Service and now heads an open source consultancy.
You need to know which open sources are very difficult to influence by any state. So new graveyards is something that you can't deny. If you make satellite imagery of new graveyards that weren't there a year ago, that's pretty objective, isn't it?
Some observers believe the figures this research has yielded are much lower than the real ones. Russian society, they say, no longer uses social networks to talk about political or military issues as freely as they did a decade ago. Access to information is much more limited now than it was in 2014. This is the opinion of the Russian analyst Pavel Lusin, a visiting scholar at Tufts University's Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy in the U.S. state of Massachusetts. He says that 10 years ago, people in Russia were more open. There were many fewer people who kept their pages closed and not accessible to outsiders. He says it was possible to open the page of practically anyone and see what kind of life he or she led. Kyiv, for its part, has given an official death toll, although that too is questioned by some. President Volodymyr Zelensky in February said 31,000 Ukrainian soldiers have died since the start of the full-scale invasion, but that figure has also not been verified. Russia's tactics have been dubbed by some as equivalent to a, quote, meat grinder, unquote. Despite mounting evidence of extremely high casualties, they see no sign that Moscow will change the way it is fighting the war. Keir Giles, a senior consulting fellow in the Russia and Eurasia program at Chatham House, explains.
In Russia's tactics of assault, we've seen over and over again that just throwing bodies into the firing line counts as valid tactics as far as Russia is concerned. If they throw in more bodies than Ukraine has bullets, then they win.
Russia shows no intention of clearing the fog of disinformation on its casualty figures or on the realities that its soldiers are living in the battlefields of Ukraine. For Ricardo Marquina, Elizabeth Chernev, VOA News.
South Korean Defense Minister Shin Won-sik said on Wednesday that South Korea held talks on joining a part of the AUKUS defense deal between the U.S., Britain, and Australia. This only weeks after the pact said it would hold formal talks on Japan's entry. AUKUS is a two-stage security pact formed by the three countries in 2021. It's part of efforts to push back against China's growing power in the Asia-Pacific region. Shin Won-sik is South Korea's defense minister.
Our government supports AUKUS's efforts to enhance the regional peace and prosperity. We also welcome that AUKUS members are considering South Korea as an additional partner for the AUKUS Pillar 2 activities. I am looking forward to seeing our defense science and technology capabilities to contribute to the development of the AUKUS team and the regional peace. We had consultations on the general bilateral cooperation in today's meeting, and we will continue to communicate with the AUKUS team regarding the expansion of the Pillar 2 cooperation.
A first stage of the agreement is to give Australia nuclear submarine technology and is limited to the core trio of countries. The second stage, or Pillar 2, is focused on sharing military technology across a range of areas, including quantum computing and hypersonic missiles. Penny Wong is Australia's foreign minister.
I think history shows us that what happens on the Korean Peninsula matters to the security and stability of our region. We have no doubt that North Korea's destabilizing, provocative, escalatory actions are contrary, are a threat to international peace and security, as well as to the peace and security of the ROK. We see it as very important that the international community exert and assert as much pressure as possible on the DPRK.
The meeting between the Australian and South Korean defense and foreign ministers in Melbourne covered a range of foreign affairs and security issues, including North Korea and the Middle East. And finally today, firefighters in Greece are rolling out some new tactics as fire season begins. The AP's Charles de Ledesma has the story.
Under pressure to cope with the impact of rising temperatures, Greece's emergency response planners are shifting tactics this summer. They'll be relying more heavily on specialised units to fight wildfires. Airborne teams, many with training in other EU member states and the US, are tasked with flying into fire-hit zones to try and outflank the advancing flames. In the short term, authorities plan faster deployment. Fireman Dimitris Priftis says high temperatures create problems and using water is no longer our main weapon. We're taking a more scientific approach towards fires, measuring the humidity, the wind, the soil. It's a more planned method of approaching the fire. Greece is doubling the number of special unit firefighters after the warmest winter on record and with temperatures reaching 86 degrees Fahrenheit in late March. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with a 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.